action of the government of Mozambique. She is visiting the campus of the University of Illinois, and we'll be spending some time here. In fact, she will be giving a talk, a Millercom talk, tonight, so that after you hear her this morning talking with us, you would like to hear more from her, and you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, you're invited to attend that. That'll be tonight at 8. It'll be in 314 Altgeld Hall on the U of I campus. It's free and open to the public. She'll be speaking on the topic Education Under War Conditions, the Challenge of Southern Africa. And we will talk with her on that topic also this morning here on Focus 580. After Mozambique became independent in 1975, education became a priority of the new government. Actually, it had been a priority all along of those who were struggling for the independence of Mozambique. In the first 5 years of independence, primary school enrollment in that country increased dramatically. Also, there were great efforts to educate adults as well. Educators in that country faced many challenges. Some of them, of course, just come with the job of being a teacher, but there were other difficulties that most teachers do not have to deal with. Mozambique is one of the so-called frontline states, one of those countries that border on South Africa. And the schools of Mozambique have been a prime target of the South African-backed Mozambican National Resistance, also known as RENAMO. According to a report issued by the United States State Department last year, RENAMO was responsible for killing at least 100,000 Mozambicans and turning a million others into refugees. We'll be talking this morning about some of this with our guest, Graça Machel. And if you would like to participate in the program here, you are invited to do that by giving us a call. You can pick up your telephone and dial the local number. That's 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you hear the station. That is 800-222-9455. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. In the early 1970s, she became a leading member of Frelimo, which is the movement that struggled for the independence of Mozambique. Her particular responsibilities were in the field of education. She was a participant in the negotiations for independence, and after that was appointed the first Minister of Education and Culture in 1975. She is also a member of the Central Committee and a deputy of the People's Assembly. In addition to these posts, she's a member of the Secretariat of the Mozambican Women's Organization and president of the National Commission of UNESCO. In addition to that, in 1975, she was married to Samora Machel, who was the first president of Mozambique, and he was killed in a suspicious plane crash on South African soil in October of 1986. Welcome to our program. We're very pleased that you can be with us this morning. I'm glad that you can be here. Why was it that in the early phases of the struggle for independence that education was so important? After independence in 1975, it continued to be very important, a very high priority of the government. Why did you see that as being so important?
One of the ways of submitting people to exploit people is to maintain them in illiteracy and supposedly in ignorance. That was one of the instruments colonial power in our country used to explore our people and our country. Just to give you an idea, when we founded Frelimo in 1962, it was estimated that illiteracy in Mozambique was some kind of 98%. One of the highest, all over the world, it's not only in Africa. And that was also used exactly to maintain our people in the place of accepting to be ruled by Portugal, because it would be the alternative, you know. Then when we founded Frelimo, we decided that armed struggle should be accompanied with a very huge effort of reducing illiteracy in the society. That's why when we came to independence in 1975, partly because of Frelimo efforts, and partly because also Portugal had been forced by international pressure, you know, to try to change the situation and to try to make a picture that, well, something is happening to improve the situation in Mozambique. Then illiteracy was 93%. But nevertheless, it was still very, very, very high. So we understood that, you know, mastering science, it's one of the instruments of liberation. So we needed to develop education in two lines. One, spreading a primary school network to make sure that wherever people live and work, they should have a school for their children. But the same school should be used for adult programs. So we made it clear that during the day, the schools should be used by children, but in the evening should be used by their parents. Even in what you used to call neighborhoods, where housewives, for instance, mothers, were just taking care of their families, we encouraged them that in the morning they should be trying to solve their problems in their families, but in the afternoon they should go to adult education programs. And so we transformed the country into what President Samora used to call to transform the country into a school in which everyone learns and everyone teaches. That means whoever was able to read and write should try to teach others. It does not matter if you are very well qualified, but if you are able to teach others, then you should do. And we made it a political point of it. And that's why we had this tremendous success in the first 5 years of our independence, because we had relatively peace in the country, and then we could develop these programs all over the country. And in 5 years, we reduced illiteracy rates from 93% to 72%, which means 21% in 5 years was really remarkable.
Mm-hmm. You must have had some difficulty in those days getting enough teachers trained.
Oh, yes.
How did you deal with that?
The party and the government made an appeal to young people that instead of each of them trying to study until they finished university to fulfill, I mean, their personal interests, they should accept to break, even having, you know, finishing just high schools. Some of them started university, but they left the university to become teachers. So we made a political point also that to move forward, to change the society, it was important to give opportunity to each child and to each young people or to each adult to learn. And that, of course, required lots and lots of teachers we didn't have at the time of independence. So by this appeal, many young people joined, I mean, to be teachers. Many of them not willing to be teachers the whole life, but at least to accept for 2 or 3 years, it was some kind of their political contribution to the start of the development of the country. And they would accept them to be trained to teach for 2, 3, or even 4 years. And then when they feel they cannot continue, they would leave education and be trained in other fields they wanted, they felt they were much more interested in. But it was exactly because of the role which was played by young people, girls and boys in our country, that we succeeded then to have numbers of teachers we needed to develop this program.
Mm-hmm. When Mozambique was under the rule of the Portuguese, there was some education going on then, but I understand that it was the level of education provided was probably just enough to help make the people more useful to the Portuguese and not enough so that they would be causing any trouble.
That's it.
So perhaps the model wasn't, the model of education that had existed before wasn't very helpful. How did you try and develop a model of the kind of schools mm-hmm. that you wanted?
Mm-hmm. It starts exactly during the armed struggle because, you know, we had what we call liberated areas where colonial system was no longer. And Frelimo has to start running I mean, to govern the country, parts of the country, even during the armed struggle. And then the problem was put, what kind of education? Are we going to use the colonial one? No. So we conceived our own way of how to put, I mean, the main point and the stress in Mozambican reality, in Mozambican culture, in African culture, to give to our citizens the sense of who we are, in which continent, in which environment, cultural environment, and even political environment we are, and now how do we deal with the rest of the world? At colonial times, education was being brought from Portugal. They even tell us that we are Portuguese, we are black Portuguese, they used to call us. So we said, no, we are Mozambicans, we are Africans, we are citizens of this world, and we put it in our point of view what education should be. For instance, it was for the first time that history of Mozambique was taught in schools, history and geography. Even history of Africa, it was at that time it was taught. And even to know what is going on in the world in a very balanced position of what is capitalism, what is socialism, to give people, I mean, to make up their own mind of what they choose to feel, what is best. So this has started during armed struggle. And we just developed it after independence, putting it into a national-wide process, you know. So we had even to wait a little bit using the programs we started in liberated areas. And then after more or less 5 years of having a very complete national survey and having the idea of what are the major programs of development the government wanted to wage, then we adapted the system of education to respond to the needs of development of the country. I wonder if I'm being clear. You know, in our understanding, it's not only the problem of teaching people to read and write, even to train them, to qualify them to get a job. It is important also to make that being more or less responding to the major areas of priority in the development of the country. For instance, we are a country which needs to develop very much agriculture. And even in industry, we had to see what kind of raw materials our agriculture is supposed to provide to industry. And then what kind of industry we have priority to develop, using our own resources and preparing, qualifying people to specifically these areas. So to combine economic and social development with education and putting education as the provider of qualified people for development. I don't know if I'm being clear. Mm-hmm. But anyway, what you try to do is to conceive the national system of education, taking as main concern the reality, the culture of Mozambique, of our region, and then to broaden it to worldwide vision, you see. So we conceived our national system of education, not only as a political and a social process, but also culturally giving it, I mean, stress in our own reality. And not only that, trying to put it as a response to the needs of the economic development of the country, of the region, of course, also.
Yeah. I think, you know, sometimes it may be difficult for people in this country, or perhaps in any developed nation, to understand that in the rest of the world, education is a political activity.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a political act.
Mm-hmm.
In some places, it's viewed as a subversive
mm-hmm.
act. And that is, I think that is something that here, it's very difficult for people to grasp.
You know, in countries like ours, in which we had to wage an armed struggle, to become independent, the sense of liberation, you know, it was to liberate ourselves from colonial power, but it's also to liberate ourselves from the whole conception and philosophy of domination from one power to another. I mean, from one country to another. You understand what I'm mm-hmm. trying to say? Mm-hmm. And that's why when we say, okay, we need to conceive this political, economic, social, and cultural development in our own point of view, then we have to educate people to understand what is our own point of developing society and what is our point of dealing with cooperation and relationship among nations, for instance. You have to put your own point of how you are situated in the world you are living in. And this is a political process, of course. It's not only a training and qualifying people to make them able to get a job. It's how they position themselves in the society and how they position themselves in the world we are living. So it's a political process. Let me say another point. You know, one in my understanding, one of the main differences between the so-called developed countries and underdeveloped countries or developing countries, as you wish, one of the main important things is education and qualifying people and technology. Because I can't understand that, you know, only these developed countries do have enough resources to be developed. What makes them developed, it's because they are able to master science and technology better than other countries. All developing countries together, I think they are richer than the so-called developed countries, which are 7 or 10. I don't know exactly how many they are. But the main difference is how are you able to use and to develop natural resources for the development of the nations and development of people themselves. So it is a political matter, I think. It is a political matter. And if you want to control others, then you'll have some areas of science and technology you're not going to share with anybody else because he'll be in the same position as you. You see what I'm trying to say? Mm-hmm. I think this is one of problems we are going to face, we are facing in South Africa. It's not by chance the South Africans using the so-called RENAMU, they are destroying schools. They want to maintain a level of education and a level of qualification which is higher in South Africa, but it's lower in frontline states, so that they'll be in the position always to control what is going on in the region. It's not also by chance that even inside South Africa, there is different systems of education for black people and for white people. And ruling class have very better qualification than others, exactly to maintain the system of how to control the situation inside South Africa and to maintain others in the situation of being submitted and subjugated, you'd say. That's it. So education and qualification, I mean, mastering of technology, it is a must. It's a question of power. It's a question, in our case, of liberation. If you want to be equal to other nations and we want to cooperate, I mean, shoulder to shoulder in the sense that we are equal, although we are not as developed as others, at least we should have assets to qualified education and to qualification, which is giving the possibility at least to reduce the gap, gradually.
Our guest this morning on Focus 580 is Graça Machel. She is the former Minister of Education of Mozambique. We're talking with her this morning, and we welcome your calls as well. If you would like to talk with her, I have one person holding on here we'll talk to presently. And then we have three local lines open. The local number is 333-9455. We also have the toll-free line. Go anywhere that you hear the station. That's 800-222-9455. Let's talk with this person right here.
Hello?
Hello, yes.
Oh, I have a casual question for your guest, and that is this. You spoke in the beginning of the program that you were starting schools for the children there. Now, what language are they being educated in?
We are using Portuguese as a language of teaching in the country. Just as a master, or as a question of what would be, let me say, easier in one sense, and also to allow us to communicate easier with the rest of the world. In my country, we do have many mother languages, if you can say. And it wouldn't be easy to build, I mean, a national language in a situation where you have more or less 30 different languages in the country. This is one point. Secondly, it's because our mother language were not codified yet at the time of independence. They were not in the position of being used as instrument of teaching. There were no grammars, there were no dictionaries, there were no people qualified to use, I mean, our own languages as teaching languages. So what we had as an instrument, it was exactly Portuguese. Secondly, it's because you know, we don't want to be an island in our country. We have to communicate with the rest of the world and to try to grasp quickly the development of science and technology, you see. So we needed a language which could be easier to build the bridge between ourselves and the rest of the world. And that was, of course, Portuguese. And I have to tell you also that we do teach English, because Portuguese alone is not enough to build this bridge. We need also English to communicate with, the massive rest of the world.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very good. We have another caller here on one of our local lines, number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Yes, I have two questions. The first in regard to literacy, and the second, the politics of education. Ms. Michelle mentioned that the literacy rate was reduced from 98% to 72% in 5 years. And I'm just wondering, what kind of literacy are we talking about here? What kind of skills are being developed in that period of time? And what kind of, I guess, problems do you have in maintaining those skills? And the second question in regard to politics of education, did you face the problem having to rewrite your history books once you start trying to teach a history which is, in a sense, an indigenous history? I'm wondering if you could just comment on those two questions.
Oh, yes. Yes, in programs of literacy campaigns, as I tried to do, we are doing it in two lines. One is developing the network of primary schools, which by itself, of course, it dries, if you can say, the source of illiteracy, so that no many children are going to grow up being illiterate. Then it solves the problem from the bottom. But then with adults, what we're trying to do is, first of all, to make them able to read, to write, and to count, I mean, to be able to do basic, arithmetic things. So that they'll start there. But it depends if these adults are peasants, what you would call in your country farmers, but in our case they are peasants, they are still in a very elementary way of how to do farming, you know. If they are much more interested in learning how to develop their own day-to-day activity, which is agriculture, of course, then the emphasis should be done to how to teach them basic techniques of improving agriculture. If they are workers in a factory, what they would need to know is to understand better the process of production they are involved in. And so you try to develop in themselves the understanding of how to work better and how to master things they are working with. And many a times it means that you give, with basic education, the possibility of being qualified technically, you know, to combine a general science knowledge with techniques of being trained. It is proved that you cannot train someone, you cannot train properly someone when he is illiterate. Giving him the possibility of having basic education, then he can be better be qualified.
Sure.
So this is the combination we are trying to do to those who are working in factories, you know. And of course, then we have many cases, they are housewives, and they have to deal with their own problems as mothers and how to organize their lives. And many times we give emphasis on it's not really management, I don't know how to say in English, but how to organize the family give me the word.
I think management.
Well, yes, yeah. family management, and also they want to know how to deal with the education of their children at home, how to fulfill the responsibility as mothers, and how even to build the linkage with the school, you know. So we try to give emphasis in what is of much interest for adults and not to generalize as we do with children, you know. So it's more or less what we're trying to do. But the problem is even those who teach, you know, are not always qualified to do all these things. And it's something I have to mention to you as a constraint, that it is a political which involves many people, but we do not have many people who are qualified to be able to go very deeply in each issues I'm talking about. Then you asked about history.
Rewriting Mozambique.
Yes, we had to do that.
Yes.
We had to rewrite our own history. And even geographically, we have to situate, you know, at colonial days, Mozambique would be known as Portuguese East Africa.
Right.
Then just to make it sure that we are not in Portugal, first of all, we are in Africa. And that it made it necessary to rewrite even the concept of geography. It was not only of history. But we have been doing that. And I'm glad to say that one of the great achievement we succeed to do is that in Mozambique, we do have our own capacity of writing books and to print them and then to distribute from different to different schools, to different provinces of the country. And we had to put lots of importance on it as a strategical way of it. It should be Mozambicans to decide what is supposed to be taught in schools, and not only to buy any book and say, well, it's useful. Of course, we consult different books of different countries, but we want to have our own way of how we look at education and how we develop it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you very much.
All right. I thank you for the call. We will break here for just a moment, and then we'll continue to talk with our guest, Graça Michel, former Minister of Education of the Government of Mozambique. This morning on Focus 580, we're talking with Graça Michel. She is the former Minister of Education in Mozambique. She held that post from the time of independence in 1975 until fairly recently. She is here visiting the U of I campus and will be giving a Millicom talk tonight. And I want to mention again that if you're interested in hearing more from her, you should attend that. Her topic, Education Under War Conditions, The Challenge of Southern Africa. Her visit here is made possible by the efforts of a number of departments here at the University of Illinois. And she'll be speaking at 8 o'clock this evening in room 314 of Altgeld Hall on the U of I campus. It is free and open to the public, and we encourage you to attend. If you'd like to speak with her directly, you may do that here this morning by calling. Here in Champaign-Urbana, we have some local lines. The number there is 333-9455. We have another caller here who's holding on our toll-free line. Why don't we talk with them? Hello.
Prexy Nesbitt's an old friend of mine. I wanted you to know that David Enge tries to keep me off the air or give you a little education this morning.
Well, you're on now, so why don't you go ahead with your question, if you have one. Hello? Okay, let's go on. I hope we have some other callers this morning. Let me give you the number again. It's locally 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. We talked in the first part of the program a little bit about the RENAMO, the group which is underwritten by the South African government. In what ways have the RENAMO rebels tried to disrupt the educational effort in Mozambique? What have they done?
They systematically are attacking schools in the sense of making it impossible for classes to be run, but also destroying schools, to paralyze schools. And between 1986 and 88, we came even to some provinces in which 45, I mean, as a whole in the country, 45% of primary schools were destroyed. It doesn't mean that schools are not being run, but it means many a time school, it doesn't mean a building. Children are learning at open air, and if it is necessary, even sitting on the ground. But they have been systematically destroying schools, killing teachers, kidnapping teachers and children, and burning bookstores, and making it impossible to, to take books from one place to another in the process of distribution and all these things. But mainly destroying and killing. This is what they've been doing. But we try to react to that and making sure that when people are attacked, they should try to find another place, a safe place to live. What we call displaced camps. In these displaced camps, people are supposed to be assisted medically, you know, and having food and have medical assistance and whatever is necessary to survive first. But as soon as they are in the condition to start again with their activities, schools should be started again. That means we select among the community who are teachers, who have been teachers, and how many children are in these displaced camps, how many of them have already attended schools, which classes. If it's possible to rebuild the whole process, we do. If it's not, we just prepare tests, you know, to know what children have learned before and what they have not, they didn't learn, and to start again with education. But we don't want people to paralyze educational activities just because they were attacked. As soon as they can, they should try to start again. But it is one of the main targets are schools, are teachers, and our students, our pupils. I mean, especially the young ones between 10, 11, 12, even 13, 14 years old, they have been kidnapped, children being kidnapped, and they train them. They do some kind of brainwash, you know, and they drag children. And they send them back to villages. They say, you go, you attack children, you attack villages. And preferably attacking their own relatives, exactly to show that they have lost completely the sense of, you know, family ties and links. And that from then on, they can do whatever they instruct them to do, because even their own relatives, they would not be able to respect. You see what I'm trying to say? So this is a group of children, we call them instrumentalized children, who are being instrumentalized by the bandits to commit atrocities and to abuse people in villages. So they have been not only making it impossible to run schools, but they have been also taking children from schools and instrumentalize them and doing exactly the opposite of what we want them to be. I mean, what we want children to be.
We talked in the first part of the program about the fact that when the country became independent and you launched a great educational effort, there was a shortage of qualified teachers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it seems you would have a different kind of problem. When schools are a target, is it difficult to actually recruit people to be teachers?
Yes, it is a problem, I have to tell you frankly. But, you know, we keep building national awareness, or you call consciousness, that we are being attacked exactly because our enemy does not want us to build the kind of society we are building. So the only reaction which is expected from Mozambicans is exactly to continue doing what we have as our national project of building the nation. So that means we have to continue training teachers, we have to continue farming, we have to continue training health officials, all these things. So we keep mobilizing people to accept that defending the country is defending the project of building the nation. That means to defend ourselves of doing what we have decided and what we want our country to be. So it's not an easy situation in which you have to tell young people that, okay, now you are coming for a teacher's training college, you go to rural areas, but there you can be attacked and you can be killed. But the point is, who is then going to defend the country? They are Mozambican. And some of them are in the military service, others should be in schools, others should be in health centers, others should be farming, and others in the factory. All of us, we are both, you know, citizens who are working, but we are also defending the country. So it's the sense of what is expected from one, each of us, as contribution to defend the country, and let me say to win the war, and to continue building the nation. So we still have young people who are set to come to teachers' training centers. And they are coming, they are there, in different levels, for primary schools, for secondary schools, even at university and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We have another caller here. Let's talk with this person.
Hello.
Hello, yes.
Hello, I enjoy the discussion program very much, but I have one question here for your guest. Could you tell me, is there a particular model for the educational system that Mozambique has? Do you look toward other developing countries for ideas how to function in your continuing development in education? And also, could you tell me, is the United States Peace Corps active in Mozambique? And in your own opinion, what does the American government want in Mozambique? What type of government does the American government want you to have in Mozambique? And I'll hang up and wait for your reply. Thank you very much.
All right.
Oh, yes. I'm not sure if I understood exactly what your first question, but it's what is the model of education we do have in our country? Well, the system of education in my country is organized and subdivided, if you want me to say that, in what we call general education, in giving a general basic education to all citizens. We do have a subsystem we call of adult education, exactly to deal with specific methodologies of how to educate in basic education adults, which could not be exactly the same methods with children, of course. And we do also have a subsystem of technical and professional training, which is much more dealing with different qualifications we need to give to people so that they can find a job and they can contribute for the economic development. We do also a subsystem of teachers' training. I mean, to stress in teachers' training and specific methodologies of how to train teachers. And then we have a subsystem of higher education, which deals with universities and so on. So basically, I can give you that a model, but all these subsystems are linked so that if someone wants to change from one direction to another, doors are open to interact, between the system. It's something which is built as a whole, but acting in very specific areas within. This is one question. A second point you have asked, is Peace Force acting in Mozambique?
I think he was wondering about the Peace Corps.
The American
The American Peace
Corps. No. I don't think they are there. Not really Peace Corps. No, we do have Americans who are working in Mozambique. Either with contracts with the government of Mozambique, others working on NGOs, and other in religious activities, you see. But we don't have really what is called Peace Corps in Mozambique, no. And what kind of government United States wants in Mozambique? Well, this is a very controversial, question, because I think what kind of government is needed in Mozambique, it's a Mozambican question, it's not a U.S. question. Anyway, what U.S. has to do is how to cooperate with the government of Mozambique as a legitimate government, which is elected and is respected by their own people, you know. But let me say that anyway, they are very good, very good. They are good relationship between the government of Mozambique and the government of U.S. And things are being done to try to improve and to develop cooperation, especially in economic cooperation, which is not so relevant, to tell you frankly. United States now is giving some economic, what they call aid for development. It's something like $15 million, which is nothing to the, I mean, to United States. It's just the start, let me say, and I believe that we'll be able then to develop and to improve it. But the United States is also helping in food aid to respond to the needs of the emergency, which was made as an appeal of the from the government of Mozambique and the UN Secretariat. I think we heard about that. To help those who are displaced and refugees. Secretariat of United Nations has made, together with the government of Mozambique, appeal to anyone who is able to help and giving, I mean, food aid or other kind of aid. So United States is also giving aid to Mozambique in this sense.
Okay, I hope that gets to the questions of the listener. Let me just go back to his first question and see if I might restate it, just because I think one of the things he was asking about was wondering, in Mozambique, as you were developing your system of education, whether you looked at systems that were in existence in other countries, perhaps mm-hmm. neighboring countries mm-hmm. or any place else, mm-hmm. and saw there things that you would like to duplicate or mm-hmm. pattern yourself after developing the Mozambican system. Or were you doing this largely, was it a homegrown effort?
It's really a homegrown effort. But of course we learn. We do have the knowledge of what are educational systems of other countries around, in other countries all over the world, to try to grasp and to bring what we think is important and relevant as experience to incorporate in our own system. But we don't duplicate any system of education of other people. No, we learn from them and we take from these systems what we think it's important or useful then to incorporate in our own system. Am I clear? Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. We have another caller here on our line number one, a local person. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I want to ask a question. I want to know from her the role of women in education. For example, where I come from in Africa, a few years ago, many years ago, women are not allowed to, women don't pursue education as they do now. But now in my own country, women have doctorate degrees, they go on for education, and as well, they are also involved in marriage, so they can combine their education, career women with marriage, and they do very well with both marriage and career women. That is, they, as a man being the head of the family, they come back, they do their work as they are supposed to do as a mother in the house or as a housewife, and at the same time, they are educated, they teach in universities, you know, and now, like many years ago, women are not allowed to go to overseas, you know. They are mainly for housewives. But today, many of them are all over the whole world, I mean, pursuing education. And as such, even those of them who got married, they still pursue their education. So I want to know, in your country, is it the same thing as it is in my country? Are women progressing in education, or are they still bent on education for men and not for women? Thank you.
Thank you, my sister. I think you have responded to my question. Thank you very much. Because what is going on in Mozambique is exactly what you are trying to say, that with the liberation of the country, it was made possible for every citizen, I mean, men and women, to have access to education. And now, of course, women are proceeding in different levels of education are being qualified. They work in different levels and areas of national activities. And of course, they combine their responsibilities also as wives, as mothers, and even going abroad, as you were saying. But it's exactly what is happening. And it is, in our case, the result, of course, of independence and the result of the policies we are trying to carry on in the country. But can I know which country is yours?
The caller hung up, so we don't
so
know.
She cannot answer.
Well, let me ask you a further question that is inspired by this, because it's my understanding that when you became the Minister of Education and Culture at Independence, there were not very many women in leadership mm-hmm. positions in your mm-hmm. country. Was it difficult to be a woman in a high government position at that time?
It was not difficult as a social, responsibility, in the sense that I didn't have any kind of resistance from people or from my colleagues in my responsibilities. But it was very difficult in my personal organization because, one thing is to be a teacher and another thing is to be a minister. So I had to learn what was the meaning of, leading a ministry and a minister of education. And that was not easy, I have to tell you frankly. Secondly, I had also the sense that it was not only Grasa who was there. All women of my country were being tested. If I failed, of course women would have failed, because I was one of those few who were able to take so high responsibilities in the country. And I needed, in the sense of my own, but also in the name of women of my country, to prove that we are capable. If we do have responsibilities, we are able to respond to that. And to respond to the expectation, not only the party and government, especially people wanted to see women doing in my country. So it was not an easy experience to be a minister in, actually for a long, long time as it was. But I learned a lot, of course. And I have to say that when I went to the minister, I was just a teacher. And I learned to be a leader in the Ministry of Education. That means I gave a little bit of myself, but I learned much more than what I could have been done if I had only to continue just being teacher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That caller we talked to before has called back, so uh-huh. we'll have an opportunity to talk with her a little bit more. Hello, you there?
Yeah. Before I ask another question, I'm from Nigeria.
Oh, thank you.
Sure.
And my another question is, you being a minister and you are a woman, how do you relate with men in a country where men are regarded as the head of the family? I mean, do they respect you as they are supposed to respect you, or do they just look down on you as a woman? I know that in my country there are many women ministers, but they respect them because at least it's something that is coming up. They will soon see more of them. But I want to know how you felt, you yourself, the first time you started being in a real role like that. I mean, did you feel, I'm a woman, or did you just go to it and say, this is what God gave to me, I have to stand to it?
I had learned that it's possible to take responsibility and high responsibilities in society during the armed struggle, where exactly I have started to learn about all these things. But I have to say that when I became minister, I was not prepared to be minister. And I knew that was a sign of confidence from my party and from my government, but it would be also a test not only for myself, but for all women of my country, so that would we be able to respond correctly to so high responsibilities in society and in areas which were not traditional to women, Because when they put you as responsible for women affairs, they'll say, of course, women have to take care of women affairs. It cannot be men to do that. But ministries like education or different agriculture and so, they were not common before to be run by women. So I knew and I felt that it was a challenge for myself, but it was something I have to do it also in the name of all women of my country. So I had to do, of course, lots of efforts to make sure that I would give a correct response to that. Then you asked if men would respect me. I think respect you do have from people. It depends on how you do you deal with them. You have to make you be respected. It's not something they give you for granted, you know. That's why I'm saying that I had to try very hard to make it clear that I was in the position to respond to what society expected me to be as a minister. And that needed from me lots of efforts and working very hard to make it sure. I don't know if I succeeded anyway, but I tried. At least I tried. And now it's a common thing, I'll say, in the country that women are coming. Not we do not have many women in the government as such, just as in this historical process that we needed to be educated in the beginning then so that, because a government is a technical thing, it's not only a political one, but technically you have to be able to deal with the areas you are supposed to be responsible of. So we have been trying, ma'am.
We would have to leave it at that because we've come to the end of our time. Thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.